Hello and welcome. This is Lizzie and this is Justin from Turning Towards Life. We are part of Third Space, and as usual, we want to point you to our beautiful website. We are thirdspace.org, and also our particular website for this podcast called turningtowards.life, where you can sign up to receive this weekly in your inbox, which is very handy. And you can also find out about all of the past episodes of this. You can find the sources there if you want to read alongside when you're listening. Maybe you're listening at a later date and you'd like to have the source right next to you as you hear us read. And so everything is there, all diligently curated and put in there by Justin with incredible summaries at the beginning so you can get a sense of what each podcast episode is about. We are approaching our 400th episode somehow of Turning Towards Life, and we're going to do a little celebratory gathering where anyone can come and just be with us, and we can see faces and hear voices and be together on the 8th of June at some point. And we're going to let you know about that through turningtowards.life, and if you're signed up to the email as well, we'll send the link on there and the invite to come. We're also in the midst of planning a Turning Towards Life live thing that we're going to do from the autumn time onwards, where we get to gather once a month, one evening a month, our time. And we're really excited about that coming to life as well. So I want to say thank you for being with us. Thank you for supporting us. We've had some very lovely buy me a coffees through our website recently, where people have chosen to buy us a coffee and support us that way, which is completely delightful. And the messages that come with it are so lovely. And anytime anybody reaches out to us and says hello on email or any means that you can get hold of us on Instagram or Facebook or whatever, we're so delighted. So if you have been feeling like, oh, I'm going to reach out and say something, please let today be the day that you do it, because we love it and we want to ask you to be in touch with us. We love that. I think that's where I'm going to pause my preamble, Justin, and say that we're going to get into this source that you've brought by Tom Chatfield today. And as usual, we will read to one another and feel into the in-the-moment response to these words and to one another and our reflections, and see where the conversation takes us.
Thanks, Lizzie. And hello, it's really good to see you, and it's very good to be with you all. So this source is from a very excellent book that I'm loving reading at the moment by Tom Chatfield called Wise Animals, which is about technology. It's about how we shape technology and how technology shapes us, and the kinds of questions that that asks of us about being a human. And actually, Lizzie, as I've been reading this book, it's full of the kinds of questions and concerns and challenges and dilemmas that I know are very important to us in this conversation in our work, which is why I brought it. So you can, I want to recommend Tom's book, and you can find this particular source always on the website and in the show notes. And it goes like this. To be human is to be born into utter helplessness in circumstances beyond our choosing. It is to grow and change, constrained by these circumstances and biological inheritance. It is to achieve some measure of independence for a time in the context of our planet and our society's vast networks of exchange and competition. And it's to seek not only survival, but also, so long as the body's basic needs are met, some form of flourishing or contentment. There's no final victory, there's no guarantee of success, and no infallible guidance. There's only the contingent business of trying together to live and to know ourselves a little better. All of the above entails moral labor whose difficulty and significance are inextricably linked. As the parent of two young children, one of the hardest lessons I have struggled to master, like most parents, is the fact that my children's desires are an imperfect guide to their well-being. Making their lives easier is not always the best way to prepare them for a life. It's more important for me gradually to help them develop a measure of self-control, fairness, and ambition, and to show them how trust can be earned, than it is for me to constantly monitor and intervene in everything that they do. Also, like many parents, the second lesson I'm still trying to learn is that the person who all too often needs to improve their self-control is me. To love and to nurture other human beings brings pain as well as joy, frustration and exhaustion as well as delight, the prospect of devastating loss alongside the gains of consuming love. And these satisfactions and sacrifices can't tidily be separated. To withdraw your care from any relationship is to make yourself less vulnerable for a price. It's to diminish what you risk and give, but also what you can receive and gain.
Thank you, Justin. So this is The Moral Labour of Living, and it's from Wise Animals by Tom Chatfield. To be human is to be born into utter helplessness, in circumstances beyond our choosing. It is to grow and change, constrained by these circumstances and biological inheritance. It is to achieve some measure of independence for a time, in the context of our planet's and our society's vast networks of exchange and competition. And it is to seek not only survival, but also, so long as the body's basic needs are met, some form of flourishing or contentment. There is no final victory, no guarantee of success, and no infallible guidance. There is only the contingent business of trying together to live and to know ourselves a little better. All of the above entails moral labour, whose difficulty and significance are inextricably linked. As the parent of two young children, one of the hardest lessons I have struggled to master, like most parents, is the fact that my children's desires are an imperfect guide to their well-being. Making their lives easier is not always the best way to prepare them for life. It's more important for me, gradually, to help them develop a measure of self-control, fairness, and ambition, and to show them how trust can be earned, than it is for me to constantly monitor and intervene in everything they do. Also, like many parents, the second lesson I'm still trying to learn is that the person who all too often needs to improve their self-control is me. To love and to nurture another human being brings pain as well as joy, frustration and exhaustion as well as delight. The prospect of devastating loss alongside the gains of consuming love. And these satisfactions and sacrifices can't tidily be separated. To withdraw your care from any relationship is to make yourself less vulnerable for a price. It is to diminish what you risk and give, but also what you can receive and gain.
Lizzie, I'm thinking as you were reading this about a story that we tell, Lizzie, when we begin the year of our Third Space professional coaching course, which is the fantasy story of the island where it all works out, which is the myth that there's some kind of life where we escape struggle and difficulty, where we escape vulnerability, where we escape loss, and somehow we get freed from all the trouble of being a person. And it's a very, very compelling fantasy. And part of what makes it so pernicious, I think, is the idea that sometimes we look around and we think that's how other people live. We imagine that there are people who've somehow escaped the bodily, fleshy, vulnerable, infallible human existence, and if somehow that's the aim of a human life. And I love what Tom Chatfield says here in the middle. He says that to live in a world where there's no final victory and no guarantee of success and no infallible guidance, there's just trying together to live and to know ourselves a little better. That what that entails is, and this is what brought me into this, moral labor, whose difficulty and significance are inextricably linked. In other words, to be alive really asks something of us, it seems to me. And what it asks of us is to get right into the thick of it and to give up the idea that there's protection, actually. There's a line in a song that I love, I think you know as well, Lizzie, called We're All In This Together by Ben Lee, where he sings, there's never been protection in all the history of human connection, which is a really lovely, straightforward rhyme. And it's so tempting to imagine that our struggles are something that could be avoided. And I don't mean that there aren't struggles which can be avoided. Of course there are, and it's worth taking care of things. But the idea that we might somehow get to float above our lives, not only, as Tom points out, not only is it impossible, but actually the attempt to do so, what the cost of trying to do that is, that we don't really get to love, and we don't get to really be in contact with this one very tender, very inexplicable, very hard to understand, very mysterious, maybe joy-filled, certainly grief-filled existence that we're in the midst of. And I feel very deeply invited into life by reading Tom, actually, a sort of, let me look at all the places where what I'm doing is secretly acting out the fantasy of escape.
I think maybe my version of escape is denial or something. I can feel all the ways that we have some grief in our family, wider family system at the moment, that is really big. And when I'm in the midst of it and I'm in conversation and I'm feeling it, it's like deep, a heart rattling sorrow. And then I can feel all the ways that I then pull myself together, to use a phrase from when I was little, pull myself together and get on with something. And then in the getting on with something, it's like I've put it to one side. And in some ways, right there, I can see the mechanism of denial. And of course, sometimes, like actually recently, yesterday, that was really necessary for me to, I had to pick the children up from school and I couldn't be a complete mess, and it wasn't a conversation for them. And, you know, it's just like, I'm grateful for my capacity to self-regulate and put something to the side until the time is right and all of that. But I also found that in my reflection yesterday, that there's a way I can just use that thing to just pretend that this, I'm not this vulnerable person. I'm not this in love with everyone. I'm not as vulnerable. Everything's okay. You know, I've got so many mechanisms to help me through and to keep me away from this vulnerability and this risk that Tom speaks of as well. And it's a really untidy situation, and it's really messy to have grief right alongside joy and simplicity right alongside profound complexity of no solution is available to this thing, and to be with that as well as knowing that straightforwardness exists right next to it and celebration exists next to loss. And it feels like in order to really be human, we really do have to grow our inside so much. We have to be able to breathe ourselves bigger, as you often say, Justin, and learn to be with way more than it feels like we have capacity to hold in our little kind of brittle, breakable hearts. But that there is a space that can hold something very, very, very large in each of us. And it is there, and it does exist, and it's not gonna take us. You know, I think that's part of my denial mechanism in a way, is I'm not sure I can take these things. You know, every time they come along, I'm like, not this one. And then in this instance, I look at my young niece who's saying, I don't think I can take it. And I say, well, I'm here. And I know how you're feeling, and I'm bigger than you, and I know I can take it. And then I have to rise into something, grow into something in that moment that's bigger than my own brokenness in order to serve and to take care of her needs at the same time. And so this, I don't use the word moral very much or control very much, whether it's self-control or controlling anything, because I'm not sure that's what my way of speaking about that, but I'm I think I'm taking Tom's words as like self-regulation, maybe, is how I would translate it. And also moral labor, to me, that's an example just that I was talking about there of moral labor, which is I'm in my own experience and this is really hard and there's someone in front of me who's more vulnerable than me. Can I hold them? And to me, that's the moral labor, is to kind of like do the right thing in that moment by regulating myself and holding myself enough and having done enough work in my inner world to know how to do that so that I can be there for someone who's more vulnerable than me, even when it's also my grief too. So I'm really appreciating this invitation into mastery, actually. He says, you know, he's struggling to master things, and mastering self-regulation and mastering being who people are calling us forth to be in service of them being able to be in their experience without us pushing it away or denying it or telling them to pull themselves together. But being with that kind of labor of, this is really hard and I'm here and I can be big and we can be in this together and we're gonna find our way. And we don't know what the answer is right now, but I'm here and we're gonna be together in it. That's what I'm taking this whole thing as an invitation to.
Yeah. I'm really glad for the fierceness of the language of moral labor. Actually, the way that you described it, Lizzie, which was this capacity that we have to discern what the right thing to do is, particularly when I think for most of us, you know, there are clearly those of us humans who've deliberately dedicated ourselves to that which will cause harm to other people. You know, of course, that's a possibility, and we see examples of it all over the place. But I think for the vast majority of us, our moral labor is working out what the right thing to do is in order to take care of the life that's in us and around us when it's very difficult. You know, when it's very difficult to know what to do. And a lot of our moral failings are not because we intended to do something that was harmful, but because somehow we checked out, we weren't present for it. We tried to run in one way or another. And so Tom's invitation, which is like you're saying, right in the midst of those very difficult moments when we can't imagine that we can face the thing that's in front of us and somebody else might also be depending upon our capacity to hang on in there, those are the moments that we're really called. Mm-hmm. But we're also called, I think, in those moments when it would be easier to check out, and what's really called for is to be present with someone in a moment of joy or in a moment of celebration. Or, you know, actually, I think of all the times I've checked out of a moment of celebration because it's too much to bear.
Mm-hmm.
Because the consequence of this beauty of this moment, like someone's birthday or someone getting married or somebody celebrating a great success in their lives or a great delight, or simply sitting around the table with the people I love the most, the consequence of it is that we will all lose it. We're all going to lose all of this. Because that's the thing Tom says at the beginning, is it's such good language. To be human is to achieve some measure of independence for a time. We all start off completely dependent and we all end up completely dependent. And in between, there's this time when we might have some measure of our own agency. And as someone who has... I get so easily heartbroken. I can think of all of those times when in a time of joy, I can feel some part of me goes, no, don't experience this too much, because you'll only have to face the loss that comes with it. And I think that's our moral labor as well. And the context of this in the book, in Tom's book, is the delusions of being rescued from all of this by technology.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, you will be able to escape this because blah, 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 blah. And in fact, yesterday, yeah, I was listening to an interview with someone who's been involved in building some amazing, amazing AI technology that might, among other things, help cures for cancer and all kinds of things. But he said this really fascinating thing on the podcast I was listening to. And he said, you know, with our technology, you will be able to, before long, it will be so realistic, you'll be able to play chess with the grandfather who you loved, who's no longer around. And I thought to myself, some people might love that. So, but for me, what I thought was, oh my goodness, that's the last thing I want to do, because my grandfather, who I loved, who died 30 years ago, it seems to me that the moral labor there is to really honor the fact that he's gone and not play chess with some copy of him that's not really him, so that I can feel better about being in his presence. Actually, he's gone. And I suppose this is just me. I feel like I can love him better and I can be in life in a more real way if I don't try to pretend that that's not the case. So I don't want that. Actually, I want to live in the heart-rending, tender, what was heart-rending and now is like sort of tender, joyful, appreciative grief and wonder at the life that this person who I really loved lived that is now over, as mine will be, as yours will be, as all of ours will be, as our children's will be. And have that be the entry into what it really is to be human, which is to be these wondrous and finite beings in a world that both deeply supports us, but isn't built around you or me and our particular individual wishes. Like it's a marvel to be in the midst of this, even when it's very hard. And that's what I feel like Tom is inviting us to do, is don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep, don't check out, don't treat this like a fault in the system that you have to overcome or program out of existence. This is what life is.
Yeah. I'm reminded, Justin. So first of all, I just want to say something. I haven't read Tom Chatfield's book, Justin. And what I'm noticing is that I think I have I don't even know how to say this, but like, a more maybe spiritual understanding of life than is expressed here. And so I just want to say, it's quite a thing when you read something and you read it aloud, but it's like, I really, there's something in me. If anyone's listening and they feel like they know me and the things that I said, like in the first paragraph, don't feel like they belong to me. I just want to just honor that somehow, because when I read things, it's like I feel like I'm agreeing with them, but I don't want to just say I agree with everything hook, line and sinker here, because there's some things that are different to the what I believe about life just in this piece of writing. Just want to say that as a little caveat. And also I want to say, Justin, when you were talking, it reminded me of and by the way, that's particularly for any parents who are listening, who, for example, would ever think that I was just having my children wanting to be self-controlled. Like, and I know that that's not the kind of parent you are either, Justin. I just want to mention things like that, that I don't want to mislead anybody to say that that's what I think or something, because I don't. And I think there's a lot more to life than self-control, fairness and ambition. And that trust is something that isn't something that can only be earned. It's something that's inherent and things like that. So I just saying that because I feel like a little bit of uncomfortableness in my body. But the thing I wanted to say in response to what you were saying, Justin, is the story that came to me when you were talking about the grandfather and the chess was I sat next to somebody at a wedding. You know, when you're at a wedding, you get plonked next to people that people think, oh, that will be a fun conversation or something. But I'd never met this person before. And when you were talking about that you didn't want to play chess with your grandfather who was no longer here because really your moral labor was to let him go, it reminded me of this story he told me that he must have been quite elderly, and he always had a black Labrador, and I think he'd had about five maybe. And the way he handled the whole thing was just to get the same dog each time and call them the same name. And I remember this mixture of like, that's really strange, and also like, oh my gosh, you must love these dogs, or this dog, this one dog in the form of five dogs, so much that you literally can't bear that they're gone. So you just replace them and call another dog the same name. And bless him, because the characters of the dogs must have been different. And you don't get like two dogs the same, or two humans the same, or two cats the same, or whatever. And so at the time, and I was a lot younger, I remember thinking, my God, that's so weird that you'd have like a different dog and call it the same name. And now as you're saying that about the grandfather, it's like I feel such compassion for how much that man loved his one dog, really maybe the first dog. And then he it was too much for his heart to let that dog go. So he just did what he could do, which was to get another one and call it the same name, pretend that never even happened. And so it's getting me in touch with just this thing that Tom's talking about, of the kind of the vulnerability of loving, and to take ourselves back from any of it is to lose what we could be receiving or gaining from the relationship. But it's really hard. And I can feel the achiness of my heart, even talking about that man who I never even saw again. And I don't know now, and I don't know what happened to the next dog and things. But the way he loved was too heartbreaking for him to actually breathe into and be with and let something go. It was like the letting go was just too hard. And I agree, Justin, that what an important thing for us to be able to do is to let go and to let people not be here anymore. And I'm feeling an achy heart in the saying of it, and to really do this work where we let our hearts feel what they actually feel is a labor in itself. And I want to honor all of us for our capacity to even love in the first place, for goodness sake. It's just so tender and beautiful and important and vulnerable. And maybe it's like a moral labor to look at all the ways we are turning away from that and then wonder how we can turn towards it.
I think that is, it may be in some ways among the biggest questions that any of us can ask in our lives, which is the way you just phrased it, Lizzie. How do we love? What is it to love, and what is it not to turn away? Because love is so painful, as well as so excellent. Mm-hmm. And I suppose also, I really appreciate you bringing up your differences in your way of seeing parenting from the way Tom talks about it. And it's important. I've been thinking about this a lot, that we can tussle with the sources that we bring, you know, and that you and I can have different points of view on it, and we can have different points of view from the author and all that. But I suppose beyond any differences, what I take from what Tom is saying is also that the thing about moral labor is the mistake that we make in thinking about love is that we think that loving will also be a route to the island where it all works out. We imagine, well, if I, my goodness, I love you, Lizzie, and if I love you, my friend, because of love, I'll be freed from difficulty. And then when we find out that love is not free from difficulty, in fact, love is riddled with difficulty, in fact, love is at its best joyful and releasing and heart swelling, but it's also always at the same time, you said it before, like it holds together joy and grief. Mm-hmm. That the calculation that sometimes we make is, well, if loving is not going to bring me that release, that freedom, I better not love. That'll be the answer. And of course, the point is that doesn't save us from any of it either.
Yeah.
And spiritual aspect of it that you're bringing in, that you started to hint at when you were talking about parenting, I feel like it seems to me that what you're talking about is what it is to be human, is that such a central part of it is that our hearts get swelled by this extraordinary mystery of finding ourselves flung into a world, as Tom says, that we're born into. We don't choose when we get born, we don't get choose who we get born to, we don't get to choose what time with the people around. And by some miracle, many of us, much of the time, find that we can love and we do care, and that people and things matter. And I think that mattering is what makes humans humans. And the seduction of the technology that Tom writes about in his book is that it kind of is going to free us up from everything it Everything that comes with things mattering to us, everything that comes with us marveling, everything that comes with us being actually appropriately attached to our dogs and our grandparents and our children, you know, that kind of loving attachment where we both want to hold on and we have to let go. It's really, really hard work. And we could check out from it. And we probably, most of us do some of the time, which is why you picked up on the language of mastery. Actually, I really struggle with the language of mastery because I think most of us never master anything, really. That what we do is we bump along doing our best and keeping on finding out our limits. And, you know, that's our job is to keep on finding out our limits and then coming back and coming back and coming back. What precious times there can be in between our two ends of utter helplessness, if we'll keep on turning back in and if we'll take the risk of letting our lives really matter to us and letting who and what is around us really matter to us. And I'm very touched by your story about the man and his dogs, because it feels to me like, of course, you know, of course.
I know.
Who of us wants to let go of anything? That's what's so painful. And if that was the way that he could live with the loss, well,
yeah,
wonderful. But we can't do that with we might be able to do it with the black Labradors, but we can't do it with people, because there is no person like any other person. And that's the wonder and the tragedy of being a person as well.
I just want to finish with one thing. I know we're at our time, Justin, but when you talked about your granddad, you told me that you loved him very much. And this is also the spiritual element for me, is because I actually think you still love him. I don't think it's even possible for someone to be in the past when they're in our experience of loving. So I think that's part of the kind of the ongoing dilemma for me, is that I'm very confused about the boundaries of life and death at the moment. And so when your grandfather is loved by you in the present moment, because you can't just, when someone dies, you don't just stop loving them. That's not the nature of love. It's much different than that. It throws me into all kinds of questions about what this all means and where we come from and how we get to come here. And I think having children is like the most mysterious, strange experience of timing and purposefulness that is not also, it's like the thrownness, like we get thrown into a world because we're a baby and we're helpless, all that. Yes, and I think there's a much bigger context to that as well that also exists, which feels important for me to say and to kind of, and I think I'm really grateful when I read things that aren't what I am, so that I can kind of feel into more what I am and what I actually think about things. I feel this contrast in my body and I'm really grateful to know that. So when you told me that you loved your grandfather, I was like, no, he still loves him. I know he still loves him. It's like the ongoingness of all of this, and where your grandfather now lives is in the hearts of the people who loved him then and still love him now. And so then I know that there's no body that he has his being inside of, but also what's the nature of being? And the question just gets very big for me very quickly. Thank goodness, frankly. And just want to honour that you love your grandfather still.
It's very moving to hear you say that. Well, I am on this really with you, and that's why I don't want an AI representation of my grandfather, because that's not him.
Yes,
I love him, and I don't want or need to have that replaced by some artificial image of him that might promise to settle my grief, but would be a shallow, right? It would just be one of the things I've really appreciated in this conversation, Lizzie, that I want to say to both of us, and it's also to all of you who are with us, is you can hear us, you and I, tussling with this text. And that's the point here, is that we put a source in them between us. It seems to me the point is not to read a source and, you know, go, yes, of course. Like, it's to have it between us, have it be in the relationship between us, that we are both being invited and being challenged by the piece of writing and in finding where we are challenged as where we sort of naturally find ourselves in agreement, and finding out what's the same and different between us. It's a practice that we're engaged in here. It's actually a deep spiritual practice, as well as many intellectual and emotional, to put a text in between and then to use it to inquire into our lives and between one another. And I appreciate very much the to-ing and fro-ing in this between us. And it's good for us, I think, to have texts that we can tussle with, you know, and where we go, you know, or it can open us or challenge us. And I want to say it that way to you, but I also want to say it as the last thing to everyone who's with us, because this project of Turning Towards Life Live, the first season of which is going to begin in September that you mentioned before, is going to be an opportunity to practice in this way, to take very, very rich texts, to study with other people, to learn with other people, to be in dialogue and encounter with other people, and to have this three-way conversation, which is always two people and the text in, you know, both in harmony and in tension, in agreement and in disagreement, and all the learning that comes from it. And I think it's a kind of practice that many of us don't get much chance to do. If we do study, we study on our own. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we don't get to learn that way, and we don't get to be in dialogue with people who are different from us. And that's what we're going to be offering in a 6-month season starting in September. I think it's going to be a wonderful thing to join. And I wanted to say it that way for any of you who are still with us at the end of this conversation. You might consider that it would be a life-giving, joyful, maybe stretching, opening, illuminating, deepening experience to come and learn with us and with other people who are going to come and join. And I'm very excited about it.
And Justin, I just want to say, I think all of us aren't very good at disagreeing with one another and still being in relationship with one another. And so I'm not saying that's what that's all about or something, but I feel like we could all do with loads of practice around having, I know it meets a longing in me, you know, when there's something controversial happening in the world and you really want to know what both sides think. But no one can even be in conversation for more than 2 seconds without ripping each other to shreds. And I'm like, no, I really need you to talk to each other, because you're going to bring out things that will educate me on this whole matter. But you can't even get in a room together. And I really need you to get in a room together. And I really need you to not be hammered into a hole by a journalist. I actually need the experts to talk to one another and to feel deeply enough in their own well-being, I guess, to be able to tolerate another point of view and respond to it calmly and informatively, and not kind of remove the possibility of anybody learning anything from each other. So I think that's also why I'm noticing that the Turning Towards Life Live invitation really appeals to me, because it's a way that we can practice being with one another from all different walks of life and ages and backgrounds and cultures and all the things, and learn what it is to be human in a broader sense, because we listen to one another and we might not think the same as one another, but we're in it together and we have relationship. And that's the intention, I think, of that container, is to try and build the kind of relatedness that you and I have in a conversation here for anybody who wants to participate, and also have that container be able to be in real conversations.
Yeah, that's right. And it seems to me that many of us, it's a really excellent thing for us to be in contact with other humans who aren't us. It's easy to surround ourselves with ones who are like us. But also, here's the other thing that I'm just thinking about, Lizzie, that I often feel when we're doing this. I have conflicting viewpoints inside me. They're not just where you and I see something differently. And I want space to be able to say, this part says this and this part has a different point of view, and I'm holding the tension of both being pulled in. And that's also such a developmental move for any of us to keep. It's another kind of not turning away from difficulty of feeling two things at once or thinking two things at once. And I think it's a mark of what's called for in the world, that we get to do that more skillfully, all of us, is to hold differing, because there is no one point of view on most things that's right. The truth comes from being in conversation together. and more things. So very exciting to talk about this with you and about what it might be for a few minutes. And thanks for staying on for a few more minutes. And thank you everybody for listening for a few more minutes as well. And I've loved being in this conversation today, Lizzie, and thank you. Thank you all for being with us. Please tell other people who you love about this. And we are going to finish now, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.